The Healthcare Quality Cast is powered by the Quality Coaching Company. If you'd like to work with us to earn your Lean Six Sigma for healthcare certification or partner with our innovative corporate training and coaching programs to successfully scale your continuous improvement initiatives, then click the link below to learn more and apply.
Hey, quality people, welcome to the Healthcare Quality Cast. I'm your host, Jarvis Gray, and in this podcast, we spotlight today's most exciting and inspiring industry leaders. We dive deep into the career journeys of these leaders that work daily to improve quality, safety, and service outcomes for their patients, their family members, and their communities at large. Our mission is to provide motivation and direction to our listeners, encouraging you all to continue your efforts in improving the overall quality of healthcare. Now, let's meet today's quality guests. Thank you for joining in on another episode of the Healthcare Quality Cast. And today, I'm here with my guest, Mr. Alan Dial. Alan, are you ready to share with some quality people?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, well, Alan, we love to start every show with positive affirmations to really get our momentum going. So I love if you could please share a favorite leadership quote or a leadership mindset, but tell us why it appeals to you and how do you apply it on a daily basis?
Yeah, I'd say my favorite as it relates to process improvement or quality management is a quote by Lewis Carroll. And Lewis says, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. I feel like it kind of like really speaks to me on a number of different levels in the quality spaces. And it's applicable, you know, if you do compliance or if you're doing process improvement, if you're doing analytics, because it kind of speaks to keeping you grounded on, we have to have a target, right? If we want to move in a direction, we need to know where we're going. And so that's always kind of foundational in process improvement and change management. So I really, really relate to that one.
Perfect. That's one of my favorite quotes. And you're right. I mean, all roads would take you to anywhere if you're not sure exactly where you're going. I'm trying to think, was that wasn't Alice in Wonderland, was it?
Yeah, he was the author of Alice in Wonderland.
All right, yeah. Perfect. Yeah, no, that is one of my favorite. Good job. First time we've had that quote on the podcast, man. So good job. You're already off to a great start. Alan, let me move you to the next question, man, because, you know, you and I, we have great history and just the fact that we've been able to reconnect recently. You know, I'm excited to officially introduce you to our audience. So, Alan, I'd love if you could please describe your professional background, your current role, and most definitely what led you into this career path.
Yeah, so my background, I mean, literally straight out of high school, I went into the military, got accepted into a nuclear power program. About 2 years of school, and then spent about 5 years on a submarine poking holes in the ocean, and then another follow-up 4 years teaching nuclear engineering at a land-based prototype plant in upstate New York called Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory. I finished my undergrad while I was there before exiting the Navy, and started an MBA program, got into commercial power generation with General Electric, moved up through a number of roles there. I wrapped up my MBA, and if you can imagine at General Electric, there's dual PhDs sitting next to you. So an MBA was like having a GED. That's a lot of acronyms in one sentence, but silly observation. But so I started an MS program in quality assurance, quality engineering at Southern Polytechnical State University. And when we were in that program, we took some deep dives into Malcolm Baldrige quality award criteria. And I knew nothing about healthcare. This really opened my eyes up. And we invested, as I recall, this was years ago, but we invested a wealth of time, not necessarily looking at what organizations did well, but also what organizations did not do well in the context of Malcolm Baldrige. And so, like I said, it really opened my eyes up to how healthcare, and I don't say this in a condescending tone, but how healthcare lagged behind other industry segments as it relates with process improvement and quality management system. So at the time, I was a quality manager for one of the GE businesses, and had moved into a Lean Six Sigma Black Belt role, which I loved. I think I gravitate more to the process improvement side of things than I do compliance. I just love the different nature of the engagement with people you're working with in the PI role. And so I made a career jump from power to healthcare, and I was hired by a gentleman who's kind of a progressive thinker as far as bringing non-healthcare people into work with him as an industrial engineer or a management engineer, as they call them in healthcare. He brought me in. I think I'm probably expand on him later, but I was focused on emergency services process improvement, which, as you know, bleeds into almost every other domain in the hospital. And if you can picture, I didn't know anything about healthcare. I didn't speak the language. I don't want to say it was intimidating, but to a degree, I guess it was. And for me, the quickest way to learn was just to put scrubs on and jump in the hip pocket of nurses and ask questions and in a very non-confrontation. Because if you wear the suit and tie, they're just not going to talk to you like they will when you're wearing scrubs. And try to relate to them and understand them. And I learned a wealth. I mean, nurses taught me healthcare in that time, simply listening to what their frustrations were. And as a process improvement professional, you understand that that's kind of the starting point. Going back to Lewis Carroll, if I know where I want to be and I can contrast it where I'm at, now I have a direction to head and we can come up with a solution. Did that for a couple of years, got promoted to in the same organization. And I assume responsibility for surgical services, PI, as well as labor management, $125 million labor budget. Same scenario, I didn't know anything about labor. And so my first meeting was with all of my chief nurse executives, pulled them around a table and said, what's broken? And so we had some really good dialogue. I had some great CNOs and I didn't have the solutions, but I had a direction. And so I started whittling away at that. And did that for a few years and left there. I wasn't looking, but I was called by a CNO and a COO from my past that were interested in me coming to be kind of a labor productivity subject matter expert for their coaching consulting firm. So I've been doing that for about 8 years. And if you can imagine, you transition from that corporate world where it's 13 hours of meetings a day, 800 emails, you just could never hope to respond to by 8 p.m. You're coming into the work on the weekend to 5-hour layovers in an airport. So I had to get my hands around something. And that's how we came up with StaffDX. That was my pet project. And so that kind of brings me here. So I've been touring the country with our clients focused on margin improvement, cost suppression, revenue growth. And I get pulled a lot into productivity workforce management work.
Perfect. And that's, you know, obviously going to be the focus with a lot of my questions for you today, Alan, are going to be around productivity, staffing strategies, and sure, all of the above. But I do just, again, have to brag you up a little bit and let you know, since we reconnected and trying to prepare for our conversation today, I still went back and tried to find that picture of you and me and Terry Bradshaw.
Terry Bradshaw.
All right, Alan, I can't find that picture to save my life, man. But I promise you, literally, I came across it not too long ago, which mm-hmm. really made me think about you. And then since we've reconnected, I can't find it. Like, I'm scrolling all over all of my, you know, downloaded pictures. So I just have to share that, you know, with you. But, you know, for our audience, Alan and I had the opportunity to hang out in Tennessee. What was it, Nashville?
Nashville,
And just so happened to have Terry Bradshaw there in all of his crazy glory. And we got a picture of him. So
it's a hilarious story.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right. So back on script here. Alan, let's really dig down, because I've been wanting to talk productivity on this podcast for so long. I mean, in so many ways, this is the true lifeblood for any healthcare organization to really get their hands wrapped around, you know, staffing, productivity. You know, what's staffing, labor itself is what, 60-70% of all hospital budgets. So, you know, based on your background, Alan, with healthcare productivity and as a staffing expert, what are three critical concepts or topics that all healthcare leaders should have on their radar about this?
I think the first, if you look at the landscape of offerings for healthcare organizations right now and for productivity solutions, really all you're getting is reports, right? Reports don't fix anything. Use reports and data to diagnose. Groups of data provide you knowledge and insight and should guide your decision. So when you're evaluating systems, if you're evaluating a solution in the productivity space, make sure you're getting more than just data, right? You need tools for your people. I talk about this quite a bit, this proverbial gap, this language gap that exists between the finance arm of a healthcare organization and the clinical operators. They don't speak the same language. And that is a big gap to bridge. And I always tell clinical operators or leaders that you need to learn to speak their language, because on the finance side of things, no discredit to finance teams, CFOs, but they're not motivated to speak the operator's language. And so understanding what the world that they live in makes them a better clinical leader. I like to look at, especially nurses, I got a heart for nursing, no, I'm not one, that they are standalone by every financial definition, economic definition, they are standalone CEOs, right? Money was never made in the boardroom. It's made in the departments of a hospital. And so they need to understand that business and fiscal side of what they do. And on the same breath, I'll tell you that we need to equip them and empower them and provide them tools to be CEOs. Lastly, I would say, and this is a big void, most healthcare organizations don't have change management professionals, right? I'd encourage every kind of emerging leader, especially on the clinical side, learn how to operationalize change. You know, you can invest, whether it's personally or the organization does it for you, invest in some kind of curriculum that advances you so that you have some technical acumen around change management. Like, I love what you do right now. I think this is such, there's such a void that needs attention. And as we move forward out of this pandemic season, we need real quality technical leaders that can affect change with the team and sustain it. And to sustain it, there's got to be some discipline around it. We can't just say we're going to do a pilot and then forget about it. We'll never sustain or see any fiscal reward for that. There's got to be some technical acumen around the change.
And Alan, you're touching on some really, I think, important topics, again, with a focus for staffing for productivity. I mean, you hit on, you know, your finance teams talking similar language as the operational leaders, the nursing, the nurse managers, nurse directors, supervisors, et cetera,
right,
that might be out on the units, change management, and then also kind of having the right tools in place, not just having a system that gives us data and reports. Right. So right. I want to throw a thought out there to try to connect all the dots and just kind of see what you think about this. But to your first point, and this is definitely putting our financial leaders, healthcare leaders on the spot with this, but you can't hang out in the office. You got to get out into the units. Like Alan said, you know, put your scrubs on, go hang out with these leaders, regardless of the department, and learn what they're doing, see the workflows, try to connect your financial reports into their everyday situation around staffing, around, you know, developing their schedules, around the definition of a unit of service. Are we talking people or are we talking time or some right. other factors, right? Right. But then the change management, I mean, these leaders are every single day, they're constantly kind of playing an algorithm in their head that causes them to make decisions that will lead to change around staffing, around patient care, mm-hmm. around their ability to provide, you know, the services they provide for customers, for patients within the hospitals or the clinics. But then the last one, connecting the dots with the tools. So not just having something that will show potentially maybe just a schedule for the day and the reports, but something that will help them again have the predictive analytics with, you know, based on prior data, based right. on different patterns, they can make the right decisions. But then having it seamless, whether it's a computer report, an app, whatever the case may be, just kind of multifunctional from those different dots, from those different perspectives. But is that kind of connecting all the dots? Like if one takes place and then it leads into the next and leads into the next? Like
no, you're hitting. No, Jarvis, you're hitting the nail on the head. You talk about connecting the dots. So, and you just said so much there. And the hospital leaders getting in the trenches and understanding what are those gaps that we need? What are those gaps we need to build a bridge over? You mentioned an algorithm and making decisions at the department level. Well, the leader of the department, how advanced is that algorithm, if you will? I mean, just continue with that dialogue. It doesn't have to be scientific, but it needs to have, there needs to be some understanding conceptually around how the data drives your decisions, or that knowledge drives your decisions and the impact to performance. And I like to say that these operators need to get their reps, and I encourage senior leaders to, when they get in the trenches, build that muscle by getting the reps with the leaders, right? So, you know, talk to them. And I really empathize with senior leaders, because they are so overwhelmed, especially right now. I mean, I'm almost a little sensitive to be even talking about productivity in the middle of what they're seeing in the field. But my grandmother used to always say, this too shall pass. And COVID will pass and we'll come out of this. And when we do, we need to be hyper-focused on, now we need to level set, and we need to know what that waypoint is that we're traveling towards. And that's really, we can't default back to what we've always done in the past. We can't.
I know, it's definitely opening the door for more focus around these elements. Again, I mean, we're talking 60 to 70% of any organization's budget is all connected to these elements we're hitting on. Let me move you into the next question, Alan. I would love, you know, if you could talk about the biggest professional success and the biggest professional failure that you've had around performance improvement reporting or process improvement, you know, connected with resource planning. Mm. Could you share with us what that is and what did you learn from both sides of it?
Sure. So I would say my biggest success, I can give plenty of, because in PI or change management, you spend so much time quantifying impact, if you will. So I give countless examples with dollars and numbers next to them, but that's not really what I would say my greatest success is on a project level. I would say what I had the most pride in, and this happens over and over with our client sites at Caldwell Butler and Associates, where we coach, but I have to say the biggest success was the first one where, and I'll give you an example of this, created an engagement centered on productivity called Rapid Budget Variance Response. And we were engaged for the first time with that workout. And it was at a site in Missouri. And so we were fine tuning what we were doing kind of while we were doing it, and pivoting off of the staff and how it was going. Much like StatDX, it centered on a lot, there's a heavy education and empowerment component, and also an accountability rhythm in establishing some rigor around that accountability. When I say accountability, I don't mean punitive, it's collaborative, right? And there was an ICU director, it's a pretty simple story, this ICU director who, and this is common when I engage with nurses, there's a fear around productivity, right? It's people gravitate to jobs. I like to say that we're numerator people. Our human behavior is that we gravitate to the numerator of productivity is hours, staffing resources, what our input into a process. Productivity is the ratio of that input to the work demand on that process, which is, you mentioned units of service earlier. They don't like to talk about it because we gravitate to, well, I've got to get better, I have to reduce hours. And that is not always the case. And that's a very naive viewpoint of workforce management. And anyway, so she was very defensive and intimidated in the beginning, thinking she was going to have to learn some statistics or something like that. And it's not. We talked about getting reps in earlier, right? I liken productivity math to, remember that fifth grade question, Jarvis, where I'm leaving on a train in Philly going 80 miles an hour, I'm leaving LA. There's another person leaving LA at 60 miles an hour. What time do they meet in Texas? And I probably still can't answer that question, but what the observation around that is that it's situational math, right? It's understanding how to use fifth grade math in almost like a word problem. So anyway, so I was heavily invested in this ICU director. And at the end, she went from being this kind of quiet, intimidated nursing director to being vocal and presenting to her whole senior leadership team face-to-face an itemized detailed plan around how she was going to recover an unfavorable variance to budget. And it was just really impressive. And I just started clapping. And then you're in like a session or something and only one person's clapping, then everybody feels obligated to clap. So then everybody's clapping before. It was really cool. So I was really impressed with her and kind of like a proud father. The next one, I guess the second part of that question my biggest failure. I'd say for me, this is not as much a failure, but maybe a rite of passage and a really big learning moment for me. So when I worked at the division level for a large for-profit healthcare organization, I took the role after the annual budget had been created. That went purposeful. It was just the timing of it when the position came available. And I like I said before, I knew nothing about labor. So I was hyper-focused on my budget and getting out in the fields and working on some technology issues and an education campaign and things like that as I was learning. And I did not pay attention to a piece of the budget that's not, wasn't obvious to me at the time. It was tied to labor, which was length of stay and outpatient revenue. And this is kind of like, try to understand, appreciate the enemy that you don't know you have, if you will. There was a budgeted length of stay reduction, and there was a budgeted increase in outpatient revenue, which our barometer of success at the hospital level was hours per adjusted admission, and it affects that. And we get months into the budget year and couldn't understand why we couldn't, with the same patient load, and we're moving, flexing staff up and down with that patient load correctly, why was it that we were missing? And it ended up being, we had to, about mid-year, we had to have a really large reduction in force. And that was single-handedly one of the most painful memories I have in my professional career. So I'd say organizations, like we said before, we've got to bridge the gap between finance and the clinical operators. You know, we talked about that. I mentioned being diligent to be ready for the enemy that you don't see, which is, that's kind of tough if you don't know what you don't know all the time. And then lastly, I'd say what I learned from that was that the process determines resource needs. And this is a really important topic. We shouldn't arbitrarily set a target to meet financial goals without understanding what the process affords us. So have you ever seen and you're welcome to use this. I love this video. It's a NASCAR. So you ever see the sports science where they kind of break down statistically what's going on with sports? And
yeah, love that show.
There's one on NASCAR pit crews. Now, I don't watch NASCAR, but it's interesting. I show this for audiences at our client sites, and then we kind of break down what's going on in the pit crew. And the question at the opening of it is, could a race be lost by simply taking too long to put a single lug nut on? And so they break down the data and then they analyze and they validate that you can. But what I highlight from a workforce management perspective about that is I ask the audience, you have to appreciate the NASCAR pit crew is like a choreographed dance. Everybody's got a role. Everyone knows everybody else's role. They study motion, they have the right equipment at the right place, at the right time. They have modified equipment because the process dictates. Here's an example, you know, the old garage hydraulic jack for you to change a tire, you don't use that in a NASCAR pit crew. In a NASCAR pit crew, it's one pump down the 6,000 pound cars in the air to replace two tires, and they do it in about 3 seconds. But I challenge audiences, if I was to throw more resources at that process, what would happen? It would implode. It would cannibalize itself, right? Because the process dictates how many resources you have or need. If I was to take a resource away from that pit crew, it would implode as well, right? So I just like to highlight that an arbitrary financial target should not dictate the process needs when it comes to resources. The process dictates the resource needs. And you improve upon the process, right, with throughput and coaching and lean and Six Sigma and things like the other quality disciplines. I think this is why technical quality improvement disciplines are needed more in healthcare at the hospital level. The process dictates what the resource.
That's a fantastic, fantastic story or analogy or connection to make. And I mean, I imagine it should go very well with healthcare teams because, you know, look at surgery, for example. I mean, that is a perfect alignment with the pit crew type of example.
Yeah.
Good insight on both of those. Let me ask you this. This was one of my, I don't know if this good, bad or other, but back when I was doing a lot more labor management work myself, you know, to your story about teaching, you know, your nurse leader and having her do her formal presentation and the success that came from that. I used to teach also all of my teams that I worked with all of like the ins and outs. And basically, if we're going to play this game, let me teach you how to play the game. So, you know, how to get more of your budgetary ask out of your productivity and, you know, the different reports and the analysis we're doing, and, you know, just how to, you know, move the schedules or the staffing appropriately so that, you know, basically just all of the insider tips that, you know, I think we get from being the facilitators of that process. Were you also teaching those, and any quick tips that just come to mind, you know, for any of our listeners that are connecting with productivity or having to manage any of that?
That's a great question. So there's a number of them. One that just, I mean, pops to mind, and this is going to sound very high level and common sense, but the technique to achieve it is so let me start with this. First is appreciate day of week variation, right? So the goal with variable cost productivity is to staff to your volume demand, right? The challenge for healthcare leaders in hospitals is especially nursing, because they have the most volatile workload. It changes quickly, and every day is not the same. So first, appreciate that not every day is the same when staffing to demand. Second, every hospital that I go into, they're not typically held accountable for the non-productive factor of workforce management. So for example, PTO, right? Paid time off. And the conventional thought is that I don't really have any influence on that. And that's not true. And that thought process drives behavior in a very expensive proposition for the organization. So it boils down to, what does the recipe in my department need to look like? If I'm only held accountable for productive hours in my department, I can create the same schedule of all benefited employees every day of the week, and I just flex down when volume's not there. I'm staffing for the what if. This is flagrant in healthcare, right? Instead of, if I was held accountable for non-productive and Nurse Jarvis was working the evening shift, and charge nurse Allen sees that we just don't have the patient demand for Jarvis to be there, and I know that I'm going to miss productive budget, I can flex Jarvis off. Well, Jarvis is a 0.9 FTE employee that was hired to work 36 hours a week, and Jarvis depends on a 72-hour a pay period paycheck. So to ensure that, Jarvis has the opportunity to take PTO for that same 6 hours. So if I'm looking at total productivity, as a director, I'm not held accountable for non-productive because that's just the benefit of employment. When I flex Jarvis down for 6 hours every Tuesday between 3 and 9 p.m., my productive hours go down by 6. My non-productive hours go up by 6. I didn't actually have any impact on how much the CFO paid out of the wallet, the hospital wallet, right? On a total productivity basis, I'm probably missing labor. And I'll give you how I define overstaffed. And I don't use this word a lot. I'm just sharing what the definition is. If you hold yourself accountable for total productivity, and I'm flexing staff to make productive budget, but I can routinely miss it on non-productive, I'm overstaffed with too many benefited. And so there's an approach and a technique to calculate, what does that recipe look like for your department? What percentage of my staff need to be non-benefited, i.e. per diem, so that when I flex the per diem staff off, I'm actually impacting performance. And now there are a number of tangent benefits of that. Financially, one of the biggest is that I'm marginalizing my benefits burden. I had a client site in Phoenix, Arizona. This was a $17 million opportunity just in this piece of total productivity management. That's probably a sip of water out of a fire hose, and I could go on and on about that. But did that make sense?
No, that made perfect sense. And I'll say for any of our listeners right now, so first and foremost, I mean, if you're doing anything connected with staffing, I'd say follow through to the end of this podcast and get Alan's information so you can get in touch with an expert, because I'm sure, Alan, you probably could have kept going on and on. And I try to keep these podcasts somewhere decent time. but you know, the other part of it too, Alan, you know, and again, for our audience, the magic in all of this from a staffing perspective. And there's something that I'll say I didn't touch a lot on, but it was there. I knew it was there, still know it's there today. Yeah. Is that if you're not staffing appropriately, you can also correlate that with your turnover. Because I promise you, all of those staff members, they're looking for the opportunities that are going to give them a consistent, consistently well-placed work schedule. And if you're not consistent with what you're doing, and they're going to start looking. So, I mean, you identify the financial opportunity just within the internal workings of a staffing process, but then the additional financial opportunities from a turnover point of view, as well as just a work culture. Like, nobody wants to be in that environment where they can't be, have a predictable staffing. So this goes a lot of different ways, just beyond just the financials.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The culture, yeah. The team, dynamics on within the organization. I mean,
I don't mean to hijack the podcast, but I feel like I got to share this with people is there's that aspect, the non-productive piece that is not healthy for the department. The other one is, and this coaching someone the other day on this, and this comes up quite a bit, and this is something nobody's looking at, is hiring ahead. So traditionally budgets, they look at volume for the year and they can convert that to target hours based on a productivity standard. And they can convert those hours to a number of FTEs that I should hire into. And the traditional conventional way to approach us, building my department is I just don't staff any, I will not recruit into a number higher than that. Well, you just said it. I have this continual churn of, it takes time from the time someone leaves, there's a lead time to me getting the job posted. From the time it's posted, there's a long lead time to identify the right candidate and backfill. There's orientation time, which can be very lengthy depending on the type of staff member that I'm recruiting and orienting. There's FMLA consistently. There is voluntary and involuntary attrition consistently. And so you have this revolving door of a resource gap. So I'll paint a picture for you. So we'll use some numbers, just shooting from the hip here, but it'll help make more sense. Based on those variables, you can figure out that if my target number, my core number, and that means different things for different organizations, but I'm just going to paint the picture that core is that annual FTE number that I should hire into, and I can't hire any more than that. Let's say that number is 45 FTEs. Based on those variables, my actual number I may need to hire into could be 56, so that I maintain 45 at the bedside. So this is where we circle the wagons, Jarvis, and get back to what those very tangible impacts to employees and patients is I'm still going to staff 45 FTEs at the bedside. I'm just doing it with overtime and contract labor. And I'm sure you've seen all this literature about nurse burnout. And a lot of it is driven by our approach to building our departments and what that number should be. And I'll say, I don't mean to expose CFOs, but financially, they kind of like a little bit of a vacancy rate, right? To keep their labor costs down. But you're doing yourself a disservice by burning out nurses, driving attrition. And when the quality of life, when there's empirical evidence of this, when we have a poor quality of life for employees, especially nurses right now, that drives the patient experience performance as well, which affects reimbursement, which affects so many things, right? So you can make some landslide changes to your productivity performance simply by some foundational approaches and techniques. You're still paying for that 45 at the bedside. You're just, or whatever the difference is between, 56 and 40. So you're paying that for that 11 FTEs. You're just doing it at a premium rate. And at the same time, you're burning out your nurses.
Nope. And we're not even going to connect the dots even back to quality patient care. I mean, all of our listeners, again, I mean, those were the reasons why, for Alan, I wanted this conversation just connect the dots. I mean, this is bigger than I think most healthcare leaders know. If you're not doing this work every day, you probably don't pay attention to it. So definitely wanted to put a spotlight on this. Alan, thank you so much for that, man. In my head, I was like, let's go way off script. We keep going that way. Yeah,
I don't mean to hijack, buddy, but we could go all day.
No, you're good. Let me move you into this next question, Alan. What is your personal favorite go-to tool or technique that effectively supports the work you're doing with achieving staffing efficiencies?
So I'm going to be, again, be a little bit selfish. So I mentioned earlier that we've developed a comprehensive workforce management solution that's really centered on the clinical leader. And the goal of StaffDX is to resolve or provide solutions for clinical leaders that are real deck level issues for them that also have financial impact, patient experience impacts, employee quality of life impact. So this is one probably wouldn't expect to get from me, but is the proverbial call off. Now you think about this and paint a picture. This has happened across the country everywhere today, right now, multiple times. Someone wakes up, they don't feel good, they're burnout, and they call the charge nurse, Charge Nurse Jarvis. So Alan calls Charge Nurse Jarvis and says, Jarvis, I just don't. Now, what Jarvis doesn't like to get this call because now he's looking at spending, you know, depending on the size of the department, the next 2 hours of his day trying to find somebody to put at the bedside for this opening, this vacancy. And rightfully so, Jarvis's priority is patient care, right? Now, Jarvis would like to be a good fiscal steward and make a decision that's driven by marginalizing, you know, premium pay and things like that, but he probably doesn't have visibility of it. It's in some disparate system. And many times, and I'm not accusing anybody of this, I'm just sharing what I've seen, is that Charge Nurse Jarvis probably has a couple of people in his hip pocket that want overtime. And so he's going to call them first to save his day and get that position filled, that vacancy filled. So what we have with Shift Cover is, and it's an app in StaffDX that based on credentialing, it integrates with the scheduling system. The scheduling system ties to staffing grids. And you can create a quick, simple, takes about 10 seconds to create a communication that goes out in parallel to all staff that are not currently scheduled on the schedule for that day and are credentialed the same as Nurse Allen. It goes out in email and text. You don't even need Wi-Fi service. You can have cell service on your phone. You can accept or decline the shift from your phone. It updates every 3 to 5 seconds. But one of the real beautiful things is that in itself is not unique. But what's unique about StaffDX is that it pulls over the current pay period information for each employee that is on that list. So I can look and assign that vacancy to an employee that accepted in their response and is not going to go into overtime. Again, I don't want to sound like I'm too fiscally focused, but this contributes, like we talked about before, connecting the dots, everything ties to employee satisfaction, quality of life. For Charge Nurse Jarvis or House Supervisor Jarvis to be on the phone for 2 to 3 hours interrupting people at home when they're relaxing with families, that's not a good use of Jarvis's time. So it's a tool that really connects the dots in that it impacts employee engagement, satisfaction, it reduces premium spend, it fills vacancies quicker, and it does that in a really prudent and quick fashion.
Right. And I'll add on, or at least, you know, let me know if my thinking is in the right spot with this as well, Alan. But I mean, to even build a resource like that for, you know, for a hospital or, you know, one of your clients, it also forces them to truly understand their process that they'll go through when these different, you know, scenarios come up. So just for any healthcare organization to have clarity on their processes, but then to have an automated way to cover right. that process. I mean, that's just a kick that I've been on lately with the new course that I'm developing, which is all about, you know, right. process clarity. I mean, process improvement is one thing, but just process clarity is a gift in and of itself. But that's kind of what I also see in that. And then the ability to automate. I mean, that's welcome to 2021, right?
Right, right. Which is where healthcare needs to be. I mean, you're connecting the dots there too, because I mean, we opened up with if you don't know what road you're going to take if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there, right? So
I love it. And Alan, next question, but could you please share with us a healthcare leader that has had an amazing impact on your healthcare career and share with us what that impact is?
Yeah, I call him out by name. You know him, his name's Greg Blanks. And on the healthcare side of my professional career, he's the one who kind of took a gamble on, he's a forward thinker, pretty progressive thinking. And he he knew he needed to get somebody more focused on quality disciplines than getting somebody, I guess, somebody who's a seasoned healthcare, very experienced healthcare leader that maybe doesn't have the technical quality discipline like yourself, right? And so he took a little bit of a risk on me, brought me in. And he also, one thing I loved about Greg is he gave me the autonomy to be successful, but to also fail if need be and learn. And he was always there and accessible to kind of guide me back and also understand the culture of healthcare, which was probably one of the biggest learning hurdles that I had, was how do you navigate the people factors? What's the climate like in hospitals? And so he was great in that aspect. And I've always gone back to him for guidance and encouragement or suggestion my whole healthcare career.
Perfect. No, I appreciate, you know, you calling him out. I'll say next time you talk to him, tell him to look at my message. I actually sent him an invite to join to join the podcast itself.
Yeah. I think he's RVing somewhere across the United States right now.
All right. Perfect. No, very, very good guy. Very impressive leader as well. So yeah. Awesome. Great influence there. Alan, what do you see as the number one challenge and the number one opportunity for today's up and coming healthcare leaders?
Yeah, I'd say the number one opportunity, and not to oversimplify this, but the number one opportunity and the number one challenge are the same thing. The maturity of healthcare organizations to be able to change, bar none, I think. And that needs to include some kind of accountability. I'm going to say this again. When I say accountability, I'm not talking about punitive accountability. I'm talking about peer-to-peer collaborative accountability. How do we support each other? How do we guide each other? I have a real fear, Jarvis, right now about coming out of this COVID season. And we take a step back to, and I know you've heard this in healthcare organizations, just the way we always done it. And that's a very comfortable route. I always say it's so tough to focus on improvements related to managing costs than revenue, because when you're trying to change processes to impact cost, that requires human behavior change, right? Versus I'm going to go get another physician, or I'm going to change my pricing structure, or my charge master. Think about this. When COVID came around, they saw a spike in the use of telehealth, over 4,000% in a couple months. Telehealth has been around since the 90s. So why are we talking about how to bill for it? And this is just a single example of how we took a step back with the advent of something that could have been monumental in it well in advance of COVID, right? And so I haven't seen data on this, but I'd be curious to see how much has it gone down since that spike. I know utility of telehealth has increased, but how much has it gone down from that peak? So the ability of an organization to change, and what does that maturity model look like? We holistically, organizations are going to have to change out of this. And I'd encourage emerging leaders in healthcare to be brave, to challenge the norm. When you hear that, if you hear a tone of we're going to go back to what we did before, you should be challenging that. Yeah. You should be challenging that. And it sounds cliche about, you know, the phrase thinking out of the box, but we've really got to get innovative. And it should be a hunting season right now for change management professionals and emerging healthcare leaders alike.
I love that insight and that mindset, Alan. And, you know, for our listeners to hear what Alan just said, I'd say consider that on two levels. That's going to be kind of a internal personal reflection. Are you driving change, or are you promoting the, you know, adoption of innovative thoughts or change management frameworks or concepts personally? But then are you also leading it culturally for your organization? So that's going to hit you on two levels there, just to, you know, that's where my head went, at least.
Yeah.
As you shared that thought. So,
yeah. And Jarvis, I'll tell you, I'll dovetail that with, we really need a greater presence for change management professionals. There's a technical side of change management, and there is a change acceleration side of change management. And when I say that, you know, I'm specifically talking about how do you navigate the waters with people? It's it's people change. If everybody was a robot, which we don't want robots, and we need critical thinkers, right? But if it was just robots, we could reprogram them. I mean, you and I had both be in different professions, right? The human side, the human behavior side is the real challenge, right? And I learned that probably later than I should have in my journey, but the ability of an organization to change, their maturity model for that really is more towards the people's acceptance of change and the be able to influence and affect change through teams. But I do think there needs to be a focus on the technical aspect. You need that technical acumen to be able to do that as well. The quality disciplines.
Yeah. And it exists for a reason. I mean, we can't just feel our way to improvement. Right. You got to build both sides.
Right.
Perfect. Alan, man, you're doing a fantastic job. I want to go ahead and move us into a part of the show that I call our 2-minute drill. You'll appreciate it as a football head. You know, this official rapid fire Q&A part of our show, but just checking in first to see if you're ready before we launch into it.
Yep. 2 minutes. Let's go.
All right. So Alan, this next question I have for you, it's something of a two-parter where I love if you could tell our quality people something about your current role that inspires you to do your best, then also share with us, how do you inspire other professionals?
What motivates me, and I learned this when I was talking about my history and moving from the compliance side of quality management when I was at General Electric to the process improvement side, I really get inspired to get up in the morning and drive change with people. Like I don't need the credit. I like sitting with people, talking about their problems and working together with them to create a solution. And it feels like it's rewarding for me because I'm giving value to the people that I'm talking to. I love the subject matters that the spaces that I'm in, and I feel like I add value there. And so that really inspires me. I think, you know, to the emerging leaders that maybe, or senior leaders that are listening to the podcast, I think an attribute of that and how you do that is you have to meet your staff, you have to meet the need where it exists, right? I think in healthcare, we're guilty of saying this is the expectation. And instead of understanding, helping the leader, the department leader understand how to bridge that gap and how to get those reps in that we were talking about. And it should be more of a partnership than an edict. And so I love partnering with clinical leaders and helping them work through the problems. That's why I get out of bed.
And what's the best piece of career advice that you've ever received?
We've kind of hit on it a little bit. I had a CFO one time when I first started down, you know, the change management, project management, quality improvement path. I'm a pretty aggressive type, and I set extremely aggressive timelines for myself and my teams. And I was not mature enough down the PI path to appreciate the people factor that we were talking about before, right? So there's the technical acumen, but there's also the behavioral acumen, and how do you influence people to drive change? How do you create a burning platform? And not just an individual, but also a team. And those skill sets look a little bit different. So the piece of advice, the CFO, he's very bold when he told me, he says, look, Alan, there's change management, and then there's managing the pace of change. And you have to be proficient at both. And so it really caused me to reflect on that kind of book of skill sets that I had not fully developed yet. And so I just encourage people to give credence to, there's more than just the technical acumen. You have got to develop your ability to influence change by driving human behavior.
Perfect. I love that one. I'd never connected the dots like that before, but I like that mindset. So I appreciate that one. Alan, what do you consider to be 3 key attributes for being a productivity-centered healthcare leader?
I've kind of had I think it's the first one. We've kind of had some themes of this, and I think I just mentioned it actually, is don't expect your leaders to understand your needs when you're not meeting them at theirs, right? I mean, like, you've got to meet the clinical or non-clinical leader where they are. Second, I think you have to educate, empower, and equip them to be successful. And this sounds really like business class 101 or process class 101, but there's a difference in bumping your gums and telling people that and actually operationalizing it. Executive leaders are so consumed and busy in the hospital. And I would challenge, you know, create some time to get in the trenches with those people and find out what those gaps are that they need. I really look at department leaders as CEOs, right? They have supplies, inventories, patients, customers, upstream, downstream, stakeholders, upstream, downstream, physician stakeholders, millions of dollars in staffing and inventories. They're CEOs, right? And I just said before that the boardroom doesn't make money for the hospital. So let's start looking at them like they are CEOs and let's give them what they need to do. And just providing reports is not enough. You know, and then again, you know, it's making time and understanding what they need, but it's also consciously making an effort to get there with them and partner with them, right? And muscle doesn't grow until you train it.
Love it. Could you share with our quality people a professional society and a professional conference that you think will be a value add?
Yeah, I've been a member of a few of them, and a lot of them are great. I think the one for me personally at the level I'm at is probably American College of Healthcare Executives. They're very widespread. They're big. They have where I'm at in my professional career. I think they do a really good job of sharing information and making resources accessible to you. They have a local chapter network or a regional chapter network that you can join. So it's not just going to the annual conference every year. You can go to their huddles and their meetings locally and network with those individuals in your own community that are members, but also share a lot with what you may be going through and can shed wisdom. So there's a relationship aspect that ACHE does a good job of institutionalizing that.
Perfect. And I'll double down on that thought. Here in Georgia, Alan, we have, I believe it's one, I've heard at least, one of the biggest ACHE state chapters in the country, and they are very, very engaged. Literally thousands of healthcare leaders, executives, right. All of the above.
Yeah, so, it's a great organization.
Yeah. So for our emerging leaders, especially, well, heck, I guess, honestly, for any level of leader, you're going to find the right folks to collaborate with, to network with, to grow with, and potentially find new opportunities with. So,
right.
Great. Great. Alan, if you could recommend one book to our quality people, what would it be and why?
I'm going to be selfish again. I'd love for people to read my book. Now, forewarning, it's not finished. So I am writing chapters and posting it. And, you know, dovetailing off of this desire to, especially nursing, I really feel this commitment to give back to them. It's really geared towards nursing, but it's applicable in any healthcare organization, you know, department leader level. I think my vision for it was that it kind of be a something they could put in their hip pocket and pick up and read quickly every now and then and kind of help them get their reps in, you know, when they're alone. It's called The Class You Missed at Nursing School. The first four chapters are written and they're posted, and I'm continuing to add content and add chapters there, but it's free. I'm not trying to make any money on it. I just want to give back. And so you can go there, you can read the chapter, comment on the posting, I'll respond. And I love just to get the dialogue going. And I've tried to make it a pretty simple approach to how we look. It's not always easy for some of the more technical aspects of workforce management, but I think I've done an okay job of laying it out, and I've gotten good feedback from it. So that's available, you know, for the department leader. Also, if you are responsible for workforce management, you're welcome to take it, strip it down, use it for your own education content. Like I said, I'm not being selfish with the information.
All right. And Alan, if you're okay, make sure I get the link for that and I'll include it with, you know, with this release. All of our show notes are, you know, when folks download this episode, they'll be able to find it there. And then Alan, if you're okay with it, I'd love to also include a link for StaffDX. You mentioned it earlier, and just again, make sure that folks can go check that website out and kind of learn more about the program, the app that you're building on that end as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Website's staffdx.com, staffdx.com. And from there, you can, if you want to book time with me and want to talk about some of your challenges, or if I can provide any value to you or encourage or coach you through anything, then by all means, you can, I have a link on the website so you can book different time increments with me, a Calendly link, and love to talk to everybody.
All right, perfect. Now we'll get all that included. Alan, what's one piece of advice that you would give a healthcare organization to establish a comprehensive staffing management strategy? So this, I call this my silver bullet question for staffing management.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's tougher than, you know, may initially think. Productivity and workforce management is so widespread. It may not be the time right now. It may be, I know it's going to be in the near future, but I think they have to start, foundationally, they have to start again with like some rhythm and rigor, some tempo where senior leaders connect and have touch points with their department directors. And workforce management needs to be a focus point of that. It has to be an element. And I'll go back to this accountability. If I had to choose one thing that I would do in healthcare to improve healthcare holistically tomorrow, it would be to institutionalize some kind of accountability. And I'm not talking about punitive accountability. Again, I want to give that disclaimer, but the peer-to-peer coaching is invaluable, and dedicating time, freeing up some time on a calendar to have a routine in a frequency, to have those touch points with leaders and to listen to what they're telling you. And as a senior leader, actively pursue opportunities to posture them to be successful. Senior leader's role should be to break down barriers for their employees to be successful. We've got to make time to do that. And it's really tough. Right now, it's really tough, right? Almost a little sensitive to even say that right now. But as my grandmother said, this too shall pass. And we need to start looking at opportunities to create that time.
Well, and I'll double down just because last week, Alan, I was reading a report on LinkedIn that highlighted that, I guess, this time during the pandemic is being called the Great Resignation.
Yeah.
Where more people are leaving their corporate lives. I guess technically I might even be one of them, in pursuit of other things that provides greater work-life balance. But also we're about to be in the time of the great retirement with baby boomers starting to opt out. So this report was just highlighting that, you know, the crunch that we already knew we had for nursing and other healthcare professionals, it's about to get, I guess the gap is about to be even wider. So what does that come down to is having proactive, innovative, you know, thoughts, solutions, plans, disciplines, like you just said, for staffing, for workforce management, all of the above. So again, that's the value in this conversation. And I think that the timing is perfect once we get this posted for you and for our audience overall. Yeah. So love that mindset. Alan, we're right there at the very end, man. So for our closer today,
yeah.
Let's say that we're sitting here a year from now, celebrating what a great year it's been for you and the work that you're leading. Take a second to think about it, but what exactly did we achieve this year? And most importantly, how are we celebrating?
Well, celebration's easy for me. I hope that my family, my boat, some flat water, and bright sun's involved. You're welcome to be there, Jarvis. As far as what we're celebrating, I'd like to see that StaffDX is at the 100,000 subscriber level, the use adoptions jumped up to 100,000. I think this is very achievable for us, given the feedback that we're getting from this solution. Another aspect is I see an emerging presence of ambulatory surgery and home health, the total patient continuum in our community. And we are aggressively focusing on creating a StaffDX, a version of StaffDX that addresses their specific needs. We're partnering with some surgery center companies and some home health organizations to kind of define what that looks like. So the acute care model of StaffDX is kind of the meat and potatoes of what they need, but there are some value proposition things that are specific to home health and ambulatory surgery that we want to add to create a better value proposition for that user group. So I'd like to see some penetration there, but we're already on the way to it. So we're excited about that.
Well, wonderful. Well, you know, it goes without saying, I hope and pray, you know, you guys are able to get there as quickly, as successfully as possible, continue adding value back to the industry and to your clients. And for celebrating, I'm all in. For a second, I thought you were going to say something like watching FSU football.
Beat Miami.
Oh, see, here we go. Here we go.
Next weekend. Not FSU Miami, but next weekend starts. I'm excited.
We got Alabama coming up. So, yeah, it's going to be a big kickoff. Mm-hmm. But no, Alan, man, seriously, I am so honored again just for this chance to reconnect with you in this conversation, to share your background, your expertise with our audience. Man, this has been awesome. I'm glad we didn't go too far off script, because there were a lot of good pieces of this conversation where I was just like, oh, I wanted to dig in. So we might have to do a part two in the very near future, man.
I'm grateful for you in my life. I'm grateful for you giving me some time with your listeners, and excited by the things that you're doing as well.
I appreciate it. But before we let you go, Alan, could you share with us the best way for our audience to connect or follow with you on social media, and then we'll officially sign off?
Sure. You can just go to StaffDX at follow StaffDX at on LinkedIn. You can email me at hello@staffdx.com. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. It's probably the simplest way. Just look for me on there. And we do have a Facebook page as well. You can search for StaffDX, and a Twitter page for StaffDX as well.
Perfect. Now we'll get those included, you know, with the post here. Alan, I appreciate you again, man. I'm like checking my notes to make sure I didn't leave anything off to cover, but no, seriously, thank you so much for the time today. For our quality people everywhere, thank you all for listening and making us a part of your day. This is Jarvis and Alan, and we're signing off.
Thank you.
Quality people, thank you so much again for plugging in with today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please feel free to share it using the social media link posted in the notes below. I'd also be very grateful if you could subscribe, give us a rating, and also share feedback on what additional value we can bring to you through this podcast. That helps a lot with our show rankings and also with getting this great content out to healthcare leaders around the world. And if you want to engage with me directly, then please connect with me on LinkedIn, where I share additional resources, access to our QI community, and much more. All right, quality people, thank you again, and I'll see you back here next week when I introduce you to another quality guest.